I'm Brian Anderson, editor of City Journal, and I'm here today with Stefan Kanfer, author of the new book, Somebody, The Reckless Life and Remarkable Career of Marlon Brando, available now from Alfred A. Knopf Publishers. Steve is a City Journal contributing editor and a prolific cultural critic and author of numerous books, including Ball of Fire, a wonderful biography of Lucille Ball, and Groucho, a bio of Groucho Marx. He spent over 20 years as a writer and editor at Time magazine, where he served as the first byline film critic between 1967 and 1972. He is the primary interviewer in the Academy Award-nominated documentary The Lion King and a literary lion of the New York Public Library. Steve, thanks for joining us today.
It's my pleasure, Brian.
Now, over the course of your career, you've known many Hollywood luminaries, but as I understand it, you never actually met Brando. So what drew you to write this this book?
I used to look at movies all the time, old ones as well as new ones, and I realized there was a great schism between what I would call old-style acting, which was often wonderful. Take Spencer Tracy as an example. And what happened after the 50s, and I realized what happened after the 50s was Marlon Brando, who changed the style of acting. And I wanted to see what made the man tick and why he was so important in a way that you'd say Hemingway was important to writing because his writing before Hemingway, then there's Hemingway and there's writing after Hemingway, and the same thing is true of Picasso and even of Frank Sinatra. There's singing before, there's Sinatra, and then there's after Sinatra, and Brando is like that in the whole history of American cinema.
Now, Brando had a very harsh upbringing.
He did. His father was quite brutal and an alcoholic, and his mother was a fall-down alcoholic whom he used to bring home from bars at the age of 14, so you can imagine the humiliation of that. And his father told him that he would never amount to anything. He had two sisters, and his father didn't bother much with them except driving them to alcoholism, too. And Marlon, his whole life long, with all of the awards and all the accolades and all the money and all the recognition, never believed that he amounted to anything personally.
That's quite tragic. Do you think it's the case that this harsh upbringing influenced his career choices and really led him into acting?
I think it led him into acting. I think the career choices was largely a matter of kind of indifference to his profession. He never believed that any actor was an artist. Of course he was, and many another actor is, but he simply refused to recognize it. And after his first five or six movies in which he made such an extraordinary impact, plus the fact that he was the best-known actor at the age of 24 on Broadway when he played Stanley Kowalski in Streetcar Named Desire, after those initial movies, it was sort of a hit and miss for him because I don't think he really cared all that much about what he did until the resurgence in 1972 with The Godfather and Last Tango in Paris when he came back big time.
Well, you mentioned two of his later films, which were quite successful. If you were to drop a list of your six or seven iconic Brando movies, what would they be?
There's one that very few people have seen called The Men, which is the very first movie in which he played a paraplegic, a veteran who had no life below the waist. And he lived with such wounded men for several weeks and really learned not only how to operate a wheelchair, but how to move from the wheelchair to a bed, to down the hall with on crutches and so on. His moves are very genuine. Up to that point, it used to be said by S.J. Perlman that in one film that Ray Milland was going to be brought to 10th Avenue, whereas formerly 10th Avenue was brought to Ray Milland because that was the way actors usually worked. They worked on a set. Marlon really threw himself into a role, and after him, other people did as well.
What year was that movie?
1950.
Made? 1950.
And after that came Streetcar Named Desire, in which you could see the power of his acting and also that kind of wound that he would show because he always operated without a net and without a mask. He was whatever you saw. He was a very genuine actor. He often refused to learn his lines. And it was not because he was lazy, although he became so later. It was because he wanted to reach, to stretch, to sort of make up the words as he went along. He knew what the scene had to say, and he knew individual lines, but he wanted to make the experience as fresh as possible. He used to drive other actors crazy. Jessica Tandy in Streetcar used to say he's an impossible psychopathic bastard, and her husband, Hume Cronin, said, yes, but you can learn a lot from this psychopathic bastard, and so she did.
And so he would prepare very intensely for his role.
He would prepare physically intensely and emotionally intensely, sometimes not in a textual sense. Sometimes he would know what the speech was to say in context, but he would make up words. For example, when in On the Waterfront, the most famous scene in that movie. It takes place in the back of a taxi. It was written out very carefully by Bud Schulberg, and they tried 10 takes. None of them worked. And Marlon said to the director, Ilya Kazan, let me wing one. And that's the one they used. He just had this power, this ability to say, look, if a man's brother pulls a gun on him, he's not going to be frightened. He's going to say, Charlie, what are you? And that became the whole, I could have been a contender speech, which rocked the show business. And to this day, it has the power to move you.
Now, you mentioned some of his unwise career choices when it came to selecting films. Were there particular clunkers that have gone down in history?
Candy is probably the worst movie ever made anywhere by any country, and he's quite ghastly in that. There are films that are worth seeing, even though the film isn't very good, because Marlon almost always gave a twist to it. For example, Mutiny on the Bounty. He plays a foppish Englishman. It's not at all like Clark Gable. It's a remake. Drove everybody crazy. He was overweight by that point. He used to have to be fitted into his pants, practically steam-fitted into them. And then he'd crash diet, so you never knew quite what you were getting. Some scenes are wonderful, some scenes are very bizarre, let us say.
Now, Brando viewed acting as basically a way of making a living, as a trade more than an art form. Do you think he really believed that?
I do.
Or on some level...
I do. Jack Nicholson said he always believed that Marlon quietly knew he was the best. But I can tell you from everybody that I've talked to, people like Elaine Stritch, who are still around, and Ellen Adler, who is the daughter of his teacher, Stella Adler, who said, you could talk about anything else with Marlon, but never about acting, never about his career, never about his accolades. He would talk politics, he would talk sex, he would talk anything, but not his career. And I think he did bear the scars, thank you, Dr. Freud, of his upbringing and the fact that his father said he would never amount to anything. This is a kid who would have two alcoholic parents, but who would be well-dressed and go off to school. And his classmates, I guess, thought he was fine. And it was a big con to him. Everything was a con, including his performances. We know that that's not true, because when the performances are great, they are art. But he would never acknowledge it.
The decline of Brando was pretty public and pretty embarrassing in some ways.
Marlon Brando's life as such, not his career, but his life as such, is a tragedy because he had 11 children, three wives. His son, Christian, killed his daughter's lover. And then she hanged herself a couple of years later on his Tahiti archipelago. He had an archipelago that he owned out there in the South Seas. And he couldn't go back afterwards. And he began to vanish. This is a beautiful man. If you look at the cover of my book and look at anything made in the 50s, you'll see he was really quite an attractive man. And he wound up as this 300-pound behemoth in a 5'9" body. He just disappeared into his avoirdupois. And I think it was just a withdrawal from the world, because I think he couldn't stand the pain of being Marlon Brando.
Now, back in 1973, Brando famously refused to accept the Academy Award that year, and instead sent a Native American activist to accept the Oscar on his behalf. Now, at the time, Hollywood blasted him, seeing this as a very rude gesture. I wonder if he pulled such a stunt today, whether he would be celebrated for his
probably because
his politics.
The culture has changed so much. But in fact, you know, he was an activist. He was with Martin Luther King at the time of the I Have a Dream speech. It was no fooling, and he really did believe in it. But the black leadership at that point thought he was just a rich white guy and sort of threw him out. But the Native Americans really loved him, and they said he gave them spine to act the way they did out in Nisqually and in the other places in Washington State where they had fish-ins. And he really was important to them, and I think he wanted to make a statement. It was a little over the top at the time, but it was heartfelt. And here's another tragic thing. When his estate was gone over, it was sold, the kids sold it, and Sotheby's administrated it, they couldn't find either Oscar. They couldn't find the Oscar he refused, and they couldn't find the Oscar he won. He didn't care about them. He really didn't care about those statuettes. So I think his objection to prizes in general was heartfelt.
What did he spend his days doing in the latter years?
He had the atoll, as I said, in Tahiti, and what he really believed was that he could create an ecologically sound, wonderful resort. Well, the fact is that if you have a resort that people want to go to, you have to have flush toilets, and you have to have meals, and you have to have a pretty nice catering. And if you do, you're not going to have an ecologically sound environment in which to operate. On the other hand, if you cater to all those people and do that sort of thing, then you just have a resort and you don't have anything that's as paradisiacal as he wanted. So he was stuck in a kind of catch-22, and he spent too much time and too much energy on pursuits that really wound up with nothing.
Now, having spent a fair amount of time with Brando in writing this book, what is your feeling toward him? Is this a guy you sympathize with or not?
Well, there's a French proverb, tu comprenez, let me see if I get this right. Tu comprenez, tu pardonnez. If you understand all, you pardon all. And I think if you know the pain that this man suffered and that he really tried very hard in his great performances to do something no one else had ever done, which is to live in the moment, you have to be on his side. I would defend him as an artist against all attackers. As a man, well, you know, Picasso was no prize and Chaplin was no prize and the rest of the greats, including Sinatra, were no prizes. I think he was what Auden says, you know, you were silly like us, your gift survived it all. I think that's the real tribute to Brando, is that when you look at something like The Godfather, you'll see a performance by a 47-year-old man playing a man in his 70s with all the power and authority, a killer, but yet somebody who was a gentleman, who loved his family, and this ambivalence. I don't think there's any other actor in the world who could have played that role as well, and with the kind of influence that it had, so that everybody in that cast, in effect, was, as James Caan said, was doing Marlon. And I think people will be doing Marlon forever.
Steve, thanks very much. The book, again, is called Somebody, The Reckless Life and Remarkable Career of Marlon Brando. The author is Stefan Kamfer. And the book is just out from Alfred Knopf and is available at Amazon and every bookstore out there. Thanks again, Steve.
My pleasure.